no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein. This is Spy Talk. That's the unforgettable theme from The Godfather, and it is as good an introduction as any to our subject today, the unholy alliance between the CIA and mafia gangsters to rub out Fidel Castro in the 1950s and 60s. Sure, it's well-trod territory, but it gets new, informative, and entertaining treatment beginning July 16th in a six-part series on the Paramount streaming service. Mafia Spies is based on a 2019 book by the same name by veteran investigative reporter Thomas Mayer, with the subtitle, The Inside Story of the CIA, Gangsters, JFK, and Castro, which in turn was based largely on declassified files relating to the 1963 assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The TV series includes dramatic recreations of critical moments in the plots, lively, insightful commentary with long-standing experts on Cuba, Castro, and the Kennedys, as well as on-camera interviews with a few still-living relatives and associates of the key gangsters in the conspiracies, Johnny Roselli and Sam Giancana. Now, I don't want to give away the ending, as if you don't know it already, but the series sheds new light on the grisly demise of Giancana and Roselli before they were able to spill all the beans about the demonic and sometimes comic failures of the CIA assassination efforts. Here to talk about that is Thomas Mayer himself, who recently retired after 40 years as a top-flight investigative reporter at Long Island's Newsday. Mayer has written a number of well-received books, including the 2009 biography Masters of Sex, The Life and Times of William Masters and Virginia Johnson, which was turned into an Emmy Award-winning series on Showtime. Thomas Mayer, welcome to Spy Talk. What a thrill to have you on. You're not only just an accomplished journalist, decades at Newsday, a great paper, but you've written this terrific book on which this new TV series is based called Mafia Spies. And it takes us back to an astounding era in American life and American politics in which the CIA partnered with mafia gangsters to assassinate Castro. Let's set the scene. It begins in the late 1950s under the Eisenhower administration.
Absolutely. And during that time period, after World War II, the United States enjoyed a great victory, obviously, with World War II. But we realized that we really had to have a permanent spy agency. And that was actually the subject of great debate within the government, because there was a spy agency in World War II, the OSS. But Truman decided, no, and he broke it up. Only to a few years later decide, no, we really do need an intelligence gathering agency. And that's that. So by creating the CIA, I believe in 1947, 48, in that area, the purpose essentially was to understand, to gather intelligence, both about the political scene internationally and some of the economic scenes, but essentially it was a more passive posture, if you will. It was intelligence gathering. And over the course of the 1950s, the CIA became more and more involved in covert operations. So instead of just purely passively gathering intelligence, we were trying to affect the outcome in some countries.
Indeed, we did. In Iran, we overthrew the government in Iran. We overthrew a government in Guatemala. We were all over the place.
Exactly.
And then comes the rise of Fidel Castro and his bearded revolutionaries.
Right.
And that gets the CIA's attention very quickly.
It sure does. You know, that had followed the Sputnik satellite, which really surprised and sent shivers down official Washington. Ripple effect was considerable, but it was the satellite in the sky. And suddenly the idea that the Russians could put an atomic bomb on this satellite. So that was one thing that really rattled things in Washington. And then, as you say, Castro, who kind of portrayed himself as a reformer compared to the dictator Batista in Cuba, turned out that he really was a communist, that he really was becoming another satellite, the satellite of the Soviet Union. And the idea that Castro was there 90 miles away from our shore, that he was willing to set up a spy network, not only with the help of the Soviet Union in Cuba, but also, as it turns out, a network of informants in Florida as well, but also that he was willing to allow the Soviet Union to put nuclear missiles into Cuba. That precipitated a huge missile crisis in the early stages of the Kennedy administration in 1962, in which we almost went to war. It's quite a time period. So the idea of trying to do something to get rid of Castro, the furthest extreme, if you will, of covert operations was this attempt to assassinate the leader of another country, Fidel Castro. And so what happens from there is really the beginning of mafia spies. And so how are they going to do this? And they decide, well, maybe we can enlist the mafia. And there's various different layers of the CIA, but essentially there were people in the CIA who knew of a cutout, somebody who was essentially who would be an intermediary between the CIA and the mafia. His name was Robert Mayhew. He was working for Howard Hughes, then the wealthiest man in the United States.
Now, let me take you back and let's set the table a little bit more here. So Castro, in the beginning, was a nationalist. He was not known to be a communist. But when he takes over, he makes it very clear that he's going to turn things upside down in Cuba. He starts seizing large farms and industries and so on. And this gets the attention of the, of course, people who have lost something in Cuba, and that is, you know, fruit companies and so on. And the gangsters who have been running wild in Cuba, running the casinos and so on, they've lost a lot too.
Absolutely.
And the United States is looking at the situation and they're saying, well, you know, we can't, this is before the Russians are involved. You know, they're saying we got to get rid of this guy. Because he's, you know, he's upsetting economic interests that the United States has. And so there forms sort of a natural partnership between these gangsters who have lost their stake in the casinos, and the CIA, which is feeling quite full of itself at this time, running around. There was assassination plots in the Congo. They were overthrowing governments in Guatemala and Iran, as we said. And so the stage is sort of set when the Kennedys come in And they're not, sleepy personalities. These are guys who are action oriented,
oh, yeah.
and especially Bobby Kennedy.
Oh, yeah.
So the CIA chooses not to like put their own agents into Cuba to try to their own personnel, I should say, their own officers into Cuba to try to assassinate Castro. But the people who have the best access in Cuba and who are motivated to get rid of Castro, the mob, these are the guys they turn to. And let's talk about some of the personalities involved on the gangster side. This is Traficante in Florida right. and Sam Giancana right. in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And then you know, part of the wonderful part of your TV series, which includes a lot of reenactors, involves people like Frank Sinatra
yeah.
And other Hollywood figures. I mean, what a melange of personalities are involved in this plot. And yet, looking back, we could say it would be funny if it weren't so serious.
Yeah. Oh,
because
absolutely.
Murder was afoot.
Oh, for sure. And Johnny Roselli was the other gangster here. As you say, Johnny Roselli, he had been both he and Sam Giancana were young men who started in the 30s with Al Capone. They were drivers and such. Johnny Roselli had a health problem. So they sent him, he had tuberculosis. So they sent him to Hollywood and he became kind of the fixer for the Chicago mob. And the Chicago mob essentially, New York has five families. Anybody who watched The Godfather or has followed things would know that. But in Chicago, Chicago was one unit and they controlled virtually everything west of the Mississippi. So Johnny Roselli was their man in Hollywood. And then as they moved into Las Vegas, Johnny was there as well. But Roselli and Giancana were also involved in Havana, Cuba, at a casino called the Sanssouci. And one of the people that was also involved with him, as you mentioned before, a guy named Santo Traficante, who was the head of the mob in the Tampa, Florida area. He worked with Meyer Lansky, who is based in Miami. But Santo Traficante is a really interesting character in this overall plot. Among other things, he was second generation gangster. He also spoke Spanish. So that was something that was of great utility in Cuba. And so when they got thrown out by Castro, they lost, the mob lost millions of dollars, because Havana was even more developed than Las Vegas was at that time period when all of this happens. People on the eastern seaboard of the United States during the winter time, they didn't go to Las Vegas. They went down to Havana. And so,
this is like Miami Beach before Miami Beach really became a big deal. You could fly into Havana so easily and head to the beach.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And Sinatra was down there. Sinatra, the beginning of his career, he would play different clubs where wise guys were controlled. And there was a point in Sinatra's life. He enjoyed a great popularity, but then he had problems with his voice. And so for a while, nobody would hire him except those people that had always been loyal to him, people who ran nightclubs that were mob controlled. And so he was friendly with a number of mobsters, but without doubt, the one that he was closest with was Sam Giancana. And I know that from just looking at their both their FBI files. It's replete with references to one another. And so that's that whole aspect of the Rat Pack. I know in our series on Paramount, it's going to be on July 16th. One of the people that we have is James Kaplan, who's written a two-part biography of Sinatra. And he talks about it. But in Mafia Spies, I also look at how even the impact of Johnny Roselli and particularly Sam Giancana kind of seemed to affect Sinatra in his gangster period, the Rat Pack period that he creates out in Las Vegas. And when they're all together out in Las Vegas in late 59 and early 60s, at the same time, Johnny and Sam are being recruited by the CIA to go kill Castro. They're often out in Las Vegas with a young senator by the name of John F. Kennedy. That takes place in March of 1960. Part of the Rat Pack is JFK's brother-in-law, Peter Lawford, another plot begins in this story when they all get together.
What a cast of characters. We have to step away for a second. Okay, we're back. So let's go back to Miami here, though. There's a wonderful scene. And I must say, I'm pretty familiar with all these events. Think you bring them back together in a very entertaining way. But I learned things from the series, too, which was exciting.
Thank you.
And there's one kind of famous event that some people, you know, born later, might not be aware of. And this is a famous meeting at the Boom Boom Room, wonderfully named Boom Boom Room, of the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami Beach, where the first plot goes down. It includes a CIA agent and mafia representatives. Tell us about that famous meeting.
Right. Yeah. There's a guy named James O'Connell, who is a CIA agent, but also the CIA's man, Robert Mayhew, their cutout in his. So he's kind of like the broker of this whole deal. And in the Boom Room at the Fontainebleau Hotel in Florida, this is roughly around March. It's quite a scene, as you mentioned, that there is Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli, who are being recruited by the CIA. There's Santo Trafficante, their pal, who they think is going to work on their behalf, and certainly indicates that he is, but we subsequently learn, well, that may not be the case. He might be a double agent. And also during that same time period, Sinatra is at the Fontainebleau, and he's filming a TV special with Elvis Presley. If you actually can go on YouTube and you can see them, they're both singing together as part of that.
And in the shadows of the audience, there's an assassination plot going on.
Right. Exactly. So they get together and they say, okay, how are we going to get rid of Castro? And so the CIA thinks it's going to be a machine gun rub out, kind of like the St. Valentine's Day massacre or something like that. And Giancana says, no, I think we should poison him. We know people that we could get to him. And so the first real plot begins there at the Fontainebleau Hotel. And then from there, it's kind of a series of various different things. The CIA, in terms of trying to kill Castro, I've likened it to that game at the arcade, Whack-a-mole, you know, where you have the giant mallet and you just try to keep on hitting the eluding mole. And that's exactly what Castro was like. And, you know, I think when I talk about both my book and also the Paramount series, I think there's two things that I think I do add that's relatively new. One is the way I frame the story. I frame the story by looking through the window of the two gangsters, Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli, because between the two of them, they kind of touch on all these different worlds that are going on. So I think unlike a lot of history books or unlike a lot of documentaries that are almost like term papers, this is almost more biographical. We're looking at it's through the eyes of these two gangsters. Mm-hmm. I think that's one thing. The other thing that's new, I think, that certainly added value to me, because like yourself, Jeff, I was aware of this story in a general way. I had written two previous books about the Kennedys. So actually I had mentioned Giancana previously. But what would happen about 5 years ago is a lot of the papers related to the JFK assassination were released. A lot of papers that had been kept top secret for more than 50 years. And they didn't really provide any real smoking gun as to who may have been involved beyond Lee Harvey Oswald in the directly in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. But what it does provide, at least to my eyes, was a lot of granular detail about the operations of the CIA down in Florida. Essentially, we were running an undeclared war in southern Florida, involving hundreds, at times literally thousands of people. It's really quite remarkable what was going on there.
Right. It was the largest CIA station in the world.
Yeah, just amazing. And that relatively was not in the papers, that the American public generally did not know about it. And that also, these papers that were released 5 years ago, they also indicate that how much Castro had developed not only a network of spies within Cuba, but that he had a number of informants and people who were working almost as double agents, providing information to the Castro government from Florida. He had informants there. Mm-hmm. And there were people who got involved overseeing the CIA operation later on in the story, particularly a guy named William Harvey, who was touted as, he was quite a spy, had quite a record coming into this. He was touted as the James Bond of the CIA. And and actually Harvey became very friendly with Johnny Roselli. It's really interesting. He thought he was sincere and whatever, but he also suspected that there was a rat, that there were moles, that there were informants. He had his suspicions, particularly about Santo Trafficante. And so those papers that became available 5 years ago shed a lot of light about what was going on in Florida. And I thought that, you know, added a lot more value to my research process.
There's a funny story involving Harvey coming into the White House and JFK sizing up and saying, "You don't look anything like James Bond to me." Any event, I want to move on to one other aspect of this. Is kind of always been fascinating. And this is where the story of the gangster spies and Cuba and Castro moves, sort of bleeds into the JFK assassination, which is that at the same time that Bobby Kennedy was really whipping on the Castro exiles, Cuban exiles, to kill Castro, he's also unleashed a federal investigation of these mobsters. He's cracking down on them. It's something that Hoover, J. Edgar Hoover, the longtime FBI chief, you know, had resisted, but suddenly Bobby Kennedy's really going after the mob. At the same time, he's using mobsters to try to assassinate Castro, and that created a hell of a situation for him.
It sure did. Well, Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli, they thought, well, if we help the CIA, if we help Uncle Sam try to kill enemy number one, Castro, in Cuba, you know, we'll get the feds off our back. They'll stop investigating us. They'll go easy on us. And just the opposite happens, as you say. And part of that is fueled by something that happens that's another string, if you will, in this fabric of the story. And it has to do with a woman that Johnny Roselli met at a place where he lived, the Garden of Allah in Los Angeles. It was like a condominium for actors and actresses. And there was a woman named Judy Campbell. Now, I should mention, Johnny Roselli was known as Handsome Johnny. Sam Giancana was a gangster, not unlike a Tony Soprano. They thought he would be kind of a suburban gangster. He was married. Mm-hmm. He had three daughters. And his wife actually drops dead screaming at the kids. And suddenly Sam winds up hanging out with his old friend, Johnny Roselli, in Las Vegas. But Johnny, particularly during his time period in Hollywood, had dated a number of different people. Lana Turner, he knew and apparently dated Marilyn Monroe. The one that really floors me is Donna Reed. Johnny was kind of a very handsome, as I said, that was his nickname, but he was a bad boy. He had that type of thing. So he also was introduced to Judy Campbell. He met her. She lived in the same apartment complex. And he, lo and behold, introduces her in Las Vegas to Frank Sinatra, who has an affair with Judy Campbell. And Frank Sinatra introduces her to JFK, who in turn, Judy Campbell was described as a young Elizabeth Taylor, if you could envision that.
She was very pretty.
Mm-hmm. Very attractive woman. And she has an affair with John F. Kennedy that begins in March of 1960 and actually carries through to the early part of Kennedy's time in the White House. And we know that because there's logs of phone calls that were made by Campbell to the White House there. But what happens is, and this is described in great detail in my book, that the FBI chief, J. Edgar Hoover, he finds out about this. And there's a really funny story about how he finds out about it. He basically learns about what happens with Campbell, and he realizes that he has something on JFK as well.
And JFK wanted to get rid of Hoover.
Right. Certainly Bobby Kennedy didn't feel he was up to the task, that he was too old. It was actually the father, I believe, Joe
Kennedy. Hoover has this card in his hand that he can play against JFK.
Exactly. Hoover was the collector of files on politicians. And so this was gold. This was real compromising material on the president of the United States. So this is all that's... So you have, as you pointed out, the specter of, on one hand, these two gangsters are helping out the CIA trying to kill Castro. On the other hand, they're being run after by the FBI, and the FBI continues its pursuit of Johnny and Sam Giancana. With Johnny Roselli, they find out the biggest secret about Johnny because they're following him, they're tailing him. They find out that Johnny's real name, that he has an alias, that Johnny Roselli is not his real name. Pardon me. That it's really Filippo Sacco, and that he's an illegal immigrant from Italy. He came over with his mother as a young boy. And so the FBI threatens to deport Johnny. And so by the point in this story, this is towards the early 70s, where the late 60s, early 70s, where they begin to threaten deportation of Johnny Roselli. And Roselli is also now being subpoenaed by the Senate, that's finding out more and more about what's going on with the CIA. So there's hearings about what's going on with the CIA that takes place around 1975. And they subpoena both these two gangsters, Sam Giancana and Johnny Roselli. And now in the case of Johnny Roselli, he floats it in order to avoid deportation. He intimates through his lawyer that he may actually have some information about the Kennedy assassination. And so he does testify to some degree about what he had done with the CIA in attempts to kill Castro. But as a last-ditch effort, Roselli dangles the idea that he may be able to provide information about the Kennedy assassination. And it's right around that same time period that Johnny Roselli winds up all cut up, killed, and left in a 55-gallon barrel that floats up in the bay, not too far, just a short distance from the Fontainebleau Hotel in Miami, where all of this began.
We have to step away for a second. Okay, we're back. So the larger context here is this all becoming, starting to unravel. The mob is very upset about Johnny Roselli opening his mouth and that he's going to testify before the Senate committee investigating mafia CIA plots, assassination plots. The early 70s were just extraordinary and amazing. I mean, you've got a Watergate break-in. You've got these plots surfacing that the CIA is involved. And you've got a Senate committee starting to hold public hearings on this stuff. You've got the CIA director, William Colby, holding up a dart gun that the CIA used. All this, you've got Woodward and Bernstein. It's all exploding all over Washington. I'm not sure how much interest it was in the wider world, But one thing that did get the public's attention were these assassinations of the mobsters themselves. And this is a decade after they were trying to poison Castro. Sam Giancana, he's back in his apartment in Chicago. He tried to escape to Mexico, Mexico expelled him, and then he's back in Chicago. And then one night, you know, he's cooking up some sausages and peppers. And somebody comes into his house with a silencer and puts 6 bullets in his mouth. That's a great scene, by the way, in your series. Coming up on Paramount. I'll promote it. And then Johnny Roselli rolls up on a Miami beach in a 50-gallon barrel. We never did find out who killed Sam Giancana or Roselli, did we?
Well, you know, I think if people read my book, Mafia Spies, I think I come pretty close to
a lot of suspicion. Yeah,
who it was, and it was the person that was part of the original plot, Santo Trafficante. And why do I say that? Well, in Chicago, and I used to work at the Chicago Sun-Times, and I know there's a lot of deference to the FBI. One particular very prominent agent in Chicago, and they think, well, it was a pal, it was somebody in the Chicago mob that didn't like Giancana, and that's why they got rid of him. While there may be something to that, fundamentally, when Giancana was killed in the way that you described, whoever it was that killed him with a silencer must have heard it when they were fleeing in a car. They must have heard the cops or whatever, but they decided about a mile or so away to fling the gun out the window, and they later recovered the gun. And the gun, when they traced it back, it came back to Tampa, Florida. That's Santo Trafficante country to me. And Trafficante had been involved with the assassination of another mobster in New York City. That scene in The Godfather when somebody's killed in the barber shop, that's based upon a real event that happened in New York. And that killing involved Trafficante. But 10 years later, I think when you look at the Giancana killing, it traces back, at least the gun does, back to Tampa, Florida. And even more so with Roselli. Roselli went to dinner or lunch, I guess it was dinner, with Trafficante, his wife. I believe it was Roselli's sister and I think his nephew. And they all went there together maybe about 2 or 3 weeks before Roselli actually was killed. But Roselli knew he was a marked man. And I think part of that was to somehow say, can you get me out of this? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, or is there some way I can get out of this? And, you know, just from what was recounted about Roselli's life, and even as he's, it's interesting, he reaches out to a priest and things of that nature, that he knew he was a marked man. And so it shocked the Senate when both of them were killed. It was front page news when they were killed. And yet both of those murders remain unsolved.
He thought, Johnny Roselli thought, that maybe he could get a good conduct card when he was before a judge, as you show in one of the episodes. You know, he's about to go to prison, and he appeals to the judge, says, well, look, I was a good patriot. I did all this stuff for the CIA. And the judge says, you know, you don't get a break here. Right. By saying you assassinated somebody, whether it was for the U.S. government or not. And also in a wonderful scene, Roselli calls Robert Mayhew, who will show up in Watergate later on, is connected to the Watergate burglars. He calls Mayhew as a witness for his case to say nice things about him. And Mayhew totally betrays him and says, I don't know nothing. I don't know what you're talking about.
Mayhew is, he's a book in and of himself. He actually did write a memoir, but he was, he early in his career, he had been with the FBI. He was friendly with the CIA. But he, as I mentioned, he worked for Howard Hughes. Howard Hughes had an affair with Ava Gardner, the beautiful actress who later marries Frank Sinatra. But when she was being courted by Sinatra, Hughes was jealous. And he had Mayhew actually spy on Sinatra and Ava Gardner. And later on, cut to about 10, 15 years later, Johnny Roselli with Mayhew, they engineer the sale of some of the casinos in Las Vegas that are controlled by the mob, so that Howard Hughes will buy them out. This is in the late 60s. And what happens is the mob sells it to Hughes, but they keep their people in there. So they still get the skim, you know, the percentage of the take every night. They're skimming it off the top. They continue to do that. Hughes is realizing that he's getting fleeced. Eventually, with about 5 years, he gets rid of the casinos. He also gets rid of Mayhew. But Mayhew is one of these extraordinary characters that are all part of it. And so as I said, the thing that I'm most pleased about with the book, to be honest, is that it's biographical. It's not like a term paper history type of thing. It's through the window of these two buddy outlaws, and they're very, very different men in many respects, Johnny and Sam Giancana. But by following them through the story, I think you can pull it together and you can follow a very complicated story that is too difficult to follow otherwise.
The influence of the mob, looking back at the episodes that you've produced here and your book, it's really quite an extraordinary time in American life. I mean, the influence of the mob was extraordinary. There's a story in your book about how the mob was upset with Desi Arnaz, he of Desi and Lucy, Lucille Ball's Cuban-born husband, and he's producing The Untouchables, a TV show about how this prosecutor in Chicago went after the mob, and they don't like it. Right. And so they threaten Desi Arnaz that he's going to come to a bad end if he doesn't start changing the plot a little bit and lay off the mob. And he does. Yeah, anyway, I wonder if this is a one-off in American history, if something like this could never happen again. But then here we are back in kind of a new Cold War, as people call it, with the Russians and to some extent with the Chinese. There are a lot of gangsters around, Russian gangsters and Bulgarian gangsters and others. The USS is feeling itself up against the wall more and more with these offensives by the Russians and threats from China, where you know, the CIA, which is a very different CIA today than it was back then, I should say. In fact, I just wrote a story that came out today addressing the question of whether we could sabotage North Korean arms shipments to Russia and China. And the basic bottom line is that first of all, the Biden administration is so, you know, careful about upsetting the Russians that it's hardly likely, and the sand's running out of the hourglass for them anyway. And the CIA is so risk averse that they're not likely to undertake this kind of plot. You know, they might show their hand. They might get caught doing something, and they will sort of nibble it to death, talk it to death at headquarters, and time will pass and so on. But I wonder if this could ever happen again, where we partner up with underworld elements of some kind to take out our enemies. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is the question is assassination a legitimate form of public policy for the United States, of foreign policy? In other words, I think people like Alan Dulles, who essentially was the one who oversaw this big foray, the first major foray to try to kill a foreign leader with Castro. Alan Dulles, a lot of these CIA agents back then came of age during World War II. And there was a lot of debate about, well, if we had killed, if we had assassinated Hitler, would many lives have been saved? And that was certainly a legitimate question. And as I mentioned, Alan Dulles was a terrific spy during World War II. That's where he made his bones. And so I think that's something that we, you know, after what I'm talking about with mafia spies, President Gerald Ford put a ban on assassination. But then subsequently, in the last, say, 10 years or so, we've certainly seen drones used as a method essentially of assassination. So I think mafia spies does, by telling an older story, really raise the question about should assassination be part of the arsenal of the CIA? Is it the CIA who should be doing it? And if so, what are the circumstances? And how do we know? And who do you bring into the tent? And to what extent do we disclose that? And so I think it does beg that bigger question about assassination that still is very much with us today. And then will there be blowback? And if, you know, I think with the JFK assassination, the question that we that certainly has perennially been brought up, mainly, at least certainly partly because the Warren Commission did not look at this whole plot to kill Castro. But at the time, Castro said, I know you're trying to kill me, and two can play this game. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I think so much of the papers that were released 5 years ago had to do with the whole Cuban operation and such. It's something that the Warren Commission did not fully take into consideration and should have. So I think this book, in terms of looking towards the future, says, what do we do about the question of assassination?
Well, one thing we find out from your story and from published reports through the years, it's not so easy to poison somebody. You know, one of my favorite stories, we got to go, but one of my favorite stories is this, they set up this Marita Lorenz woman who was a lover of Castro's to kill him. And they put poison pills in her skin cream. And after she gets out of bed with Castro, she goes into the bathroom to get the poison pills out of skin cream, but they've melted in the skin cream. Right. And Castro suspects that this girl is up to no good. And so he says, why don't you kill me? He hands her his gun and says, you want to kill me? Shoot me. And she just, you know, can't do it. And
she falls into his arms instead.
What a scene. You know, you just can't make this stuff up. Yeah. So anyway, Thomas Mayer, thanks so much for spending time with us at Spy Talk to come on and talk about this great, very entertaining, I want to add, very entertaining series on the mafia plots to kill Castro.
And the book is now out too as well, the updated book with the cover from the show on it. And there's photos, 16 pages of photos from the show. And I also have a new update about how the show was made. So, Jeff, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Everybody should go get this book. It's very entertaining. Great stories of a particular time in American life that hopefully will never come again.
Thank you so much.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't done so already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. And that's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.